John drops these little clues, these little signs in his gospel, and we're meant to follow the trail of the breadcrumbs, so to speak, to see where he's bringing us. This is the first one, he says. This is the public sign, the first public sign of Jesus revealing his glory, which John talked about in chapter 1, that the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and he showed that there was glory. The glory of God was seen in him. In these signs, Jesus is telling something about himself, his identity and what he's all about. And he chooses a wedding to do his very first one publicly. What's a wedding? At its core, we're talking about two people who are becoming one. That's what a wedding is. Now, Jesus could have done his first sign any way he wanted. He's coming onto the public scene to begin his work, but this is a carefully chosen moment. So with this moment, he's going to make a statement about who he is and what he's about. He's setting the tone and the direction of his mission. Why this? Why now? I mean, don't get me wrong. Turning water into wine is amazing, but he would go on to do even more amazing things. He would go on to heal the sick. I mean, why not do that? Why not cast out a demon? Better yet, why not raise somebody from the dead? Then people would really get the point, right? But instead, he chose to reveal himself in this way. Now, at the end of John's gospel, he tells us that there are lots of other things that Jesus did that are not written in this book. But he says, these ones are written so that you would believe, and that believing you may have life in his name. There's something special about these stories. There's something special about this story in particular. Let's just walk through it together. First of all, what's the problem? We've got a wine shortage at a wedding. Think, all right, that's pretty bad. We've all been to weddings where there's not enough food or there's not enough drinks, and it's kind of an inconvenience because you thought there would be enough food or there would be enough drinks there. But it's not that big of a deal. I mean, nobody's dying, right? Well, ancient weddings were a much bigger deal than they are today. Because in the ancient world, they didn't have this individualistic idea of marriage. Marriage in the ancient world was not just about two people falling in love, which is kind of how, you know, we talk about it. But it's more than that. It's about the creation of a new family. It's about adding to the strength of the community as a whole, the commonwealth. The bigger, the stronger, the more families there were in town, that spoke to the strength of the community, economically, militarily, all of that. The whole community then would be invited. And we can tell, I mean, Jesus didn't grow up in Cana, and yet he and his mother and his disciples are invited to come. And so this is a huge gathering. Well, what did an ancient wedding entail? Well, there's little pieces we can put together from neat documents that have been recovered. It would begin with the process of betrothal. And this was a little bit like our engagement, but it was much more serious. What a betrothal was saying, we are spoken for. And there were real consequences if that betrothal was broken. And then finally, on the day, when the day came, there was the dress. And the man would wear sometimes a robe, maybe even a diadem. He would be dressing like a king. And of course, the bride, she would wear the very best that her family had, maybe grandmother's dress and jewelry or something like that. And then the day of the wedding, there would be this grand procession. After the sun went down, the Jewish day began at sunset, the groom would leave his house with all the groomsmen. And he would arrive through the village. He would arrive at the house of his bride. Here's a neat little picture. You can see this kind of thing happening here. The bride is brought out by her father, and the groom would then escort the bride back to his house with the groomsmen in tow, and then the bridesmaids would join in. It would be a grand procession. There would be music being played, and everybody would take notice. that the bride and the groom were coming together. And finally, of course, the ceremony was held at the groom's house. But the best part of all, you guys, this is the point I'm trying to make, was the party, the wedding feast. That is the best time anyone ever had in the ancient world, was at a wedding feast. And it wasn't just for one night. They would take sometimes several days where people would take off work. They would just enjoy themselves and they would celebrate the coming together of these two people, these two families, and celebrate the strength of their community. Well, in the ancient world, the groom's father, the groom's family, they were the ones financially responsible to put this whole party together. And they would put like a steward, a manager, to organize the whole event and make sure everything was in order. So the groom's family would save up a bunch of money. They'd try to get the best food and the best drinks possible. This is the single biggest moment in this young couple's life. They're setting the tone for their marriage. They're coming on to the public scene. It matters to them. And a wine shortage meant ruination. Because wine was the most important part of a wedding feast if you were a Jew. To a Jew, viticulture is woven into your national identity. There were laws coming from Mount Sinai, from the lips of God, concerning the care of vineyards. The fruitfulness of the crop was a mark of God's blessing. Wine was meant to be enjoyed as part of Israel's Sabbath rest when they came into to the promised land, Canaan. It was a symbol of celebration, of peace, of shalom. And so running out of wine was not just a breach in etiquette. It was a social catastrophe. And so the bride and the groom, they are in danger of being embarrassed publicly. Their happiest moment coming onto the scene is being threatened here. And so what's the solution? Well, look at verse 3. Mary essentially highlights the problem. And she says they have no wine. She seems to turn to Jesus as if he can do something about it. And then Jesus offers in verse 4, look at verse 4, this very enigmatic response. Woman, what does this have to do with me? Now, that doesn't sound like a very nice thing to say to your mom. You wouldn't call your mom woman, would you? I surely hope not. But that word doesn't quite get to the heart of what he's saying. The closest we have in English is, you know, in the South, people call women, they call, hello, ma'am. What can I get you, ma'am? It's kind of like that. It's a term of endearment. It's a term of respect. But it's really, there's a word for mother. Why didn't he call mom? He's putting some distance between himself and his mother. Why is he addressing Mary in this way? I think that he's indicating that there's a new relationship between him and his mother. Because yes, Jesus is Mary's son, but more than that, Jesus is the son of God the Father. And now that Jesus had begun his public work, he was no longer primarily Mary's son. He was the son of God. And so he says, what does this have to do with me? Why are you trying to involve me in this? And so why is he offering that kind of courteous rebuke? Well, whose will did Jesus come to fulfill? It was his Father's will, wasn't it? Even though Mary was his mother and he deeply respected her, we know, look at one of the final statements of Jesus as he hung upon the cross, woman, behold your son, taking care of his mother. He had a great deal of respect and love for his mother. But even though she was his mother, she had no claims upon his mission. When Jesus went public, his only authority was to do the Father's will. Look at chapter 5 and verse 30. I can do nothing on my own, Jesus says, as I hear, I judge, and my judgment is just because I seek not my own will, but the will of him who sent me. He says in chapter 8 in verse 29, I always do the things that are pleasing to the Father. This carried into the garden when he said, nevertheless, not as my will, but your will be done. In other words, if Jesus is going to act on this day at this wedding, it's going to be on the Father's initiative and not Mary's. And I think that would be a hard lesson for a parent. I think that would be very difficult for Mary. Mary had borne him, had brought him into this world, had carried him for 9 months. Mary had nursed him. Mary had taught him. Mary had cradled him. Mary had kissed his wounds when he fell down. Mary had this intimate relationship that all mothers share with their children. But now that Jesus was an adult, now that he has entered into his purpose for coming, everything changes. And the family ties that he has are secondary. Jesus takes up the initiative of his Father. Yes, Mary raised Jesus to adulthood, but now she has to approach Jesus like everybody else, as the Messiah and not her son. And then Jesus says something else in verse 4. Woman, what does this have to do with me? And then he says, my hour has not yet come. He connects this situation with his imminent hour. Now, in John's gospel is like this, you have to pick up on those phrases and then they return and they come up again and again. And so if you're not sure what my hour is, just continue to read the gospel and you'll see that my hour, whenever Jesus uses that phrase, he's talking about the hour of his death on the cross. Look at chapter 7 in verse 30. Chapter 7 in verse 30. Jesus says, so they were seeking to arrest him, but no one laid a hand on him. Why? Because his hour had not yet come. Chapter 8 in verse 20. These words he spoke in the treasury as he taught in the temple, but no one arrested him because his hour had not yet come. But then in chapter 12, look at chapter 12. He raises Lazarus from the dead in chapter 11. And now in chapter 12, they have this mission of the Jewish establishment is ready to take him on and ready to put him to death. Jesus says in verse 23, the hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. Verse 27, now is my soul troubled. And what shall I say? My Father, save me from this hour. But for this purpose, I have come to this hour. And now, chapter 13, verse 1, before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart out of this world and go to his Father, so on, so forth, so on. Go back to the wedding at Cana. Am I ready to put myself out there? I don't want to gain too much attention of the Jewish establishment in Jerusalem. My hour has not yet come. He's not fully prepared to reveal his glory to a wide audience. And so that's why he only revealed himself on this occasion to just a few. But we're still left with this question. Why does asking Jesus to do something about a wine shortage at a wedding have to do with the cross? That's the real question, right? What does this have to do? Well, as it turns out, it has a whole lot to do with the cross. Mary shakes off the rebuke in verse 5, and she puts the situation in the capable hands of Jesus. She approached him as her son. Now she's ready to approach him as Messiah, and she has faith in his ability to do something about this, and she's rewarded for her faith. Mary wanted this wedding to end without embarrassment, but Jesus has something even better in mind. See, Jesus came to recreate us. And he came to transform us. Let's not skip the obvious. This is extraordinary. This is amazing. Who has the power to create something? Who has the power to take something and turn it into something else completely? Water into wine. Only God could have such creative power, which is John's claim from the beginning, that Jesus is that Word that was with God in the beginning and that was God. He is God become a human being, ready to reveal his glory. So Christ not only has the power to create, as he created all life, But he has the power to change. He has the power to transform something inferior to something superior. Water is good, but wine is far better. Note the purpose of the water in verse 6. What was this water used for in these great big jars? It was used for the Jewish rites of purification. Jesus came to recreate and to transform, but he also came to replace the old with the new. This was part of the law that the people of God were to understand, that God was holy and they were unclean ritually, and they could not approach God in the condition that they were in because sin had defiled them. And so they had to go through these kind of rituals of washing if they wanted to approach God. So these water jars represent the old way of doing things, the old order. That's the thing that Jesus came to replace with something better, with something new. Yes, the law came through Moses, but grace and truth came through Jesus. John had already said in chapter 1, in Jesus, God is doing a new thing, a new thing. Look at the broader picture where chapter 2 lies. Chapter 2, 3, and 4 in John's gospel. Is this not the theme of these chapters? Out with the old, in with the new? The old purifications with water, with the new wine of the kingdom. Look what happens right after this. Jesus goes into Jerusalem and cleanses the temple. It's the old temple with the risen Lord. Something greater than the temple has come. The temple of my body, he would go on to say. Chapter 3, you must be born again. It's about the new birth, the new creation. Chapter 4, when Jesus talks to the woman at the well, it's about the changing the water from Jacob's well to living water that bubbles up inside you into eternal life. It's out with the old, in with the new. No more Jerusalem worship, no more worship on Mount Gerizim in a temple. It's about worshiping God in spirit and in truth. Jesus is doing a new thing. He came to recreate us, to transform us, to bring us into a new order, and to turn our shame into joy. See, up until now, he says, fill them up with water. Now, draw from that. And what does it become as they draw it out? It changes right then and there. Up until now, up until this moment, that water had been drawn from those pots for ritual cleansing, a constant reminder that Israel was unclean, unfit to approach God. But now, at the coming of Jesus, instead of water for cleansing, they get wine for celebration. Do you see the change in tone there? And you say, well, what is there to celebrate? The new and living way that Jesus has brought into being. That now we can approach God because it's through his sacrifice on the cross that we can receive the full forgiveness of sins. And we can, as Hebrews says, approach that throne of mercy to find help in time of need. Boldly, confidently, we have access to God. We don't have to suffer the eternal shame of our sin because he suffered the shame for us, so that we can enjoy the new wine of the kingdom. He drank down the bitter cup of wrath so that we could taste the sweetness of the new kingdom. Something I think about when I drink this cup. I get to enjoy the sweetness. I get to enjoy the newness because he suffered, because he drank the bitter. We are reconciled and transformed through him, much like that water was turned to wine. What's the point of all this? What's the point? It's not just about water into wine. It's about what he can do for you. It's about changing you. It's about purifying you. You are meant to be the pure, chaste, virgin bride of God. That's what God wants. Why did Jesus choose a wedding to perform his first sign? A wedding is a union between two people. According to Genesis 2:24, the two become one flesh. They leave mother and father, and they're joined, and they become one. They start anew. God intentionally, in the beginning, creates humanity in two stages. Why does he do that? Because it wasn't good for man to be alone. He needed to see his need in a relationship. And that relationship is the covenant of marriage. The first human relationship is not father, son, mother, daughter. The first human relationship is marriage between husband and wife. And it serves as a model for the greatest relationship of all. Just retell the Bible story in your head. Israel was the unfaithful spouse to God. There was a kind of wedding ceremony that took place, a covenant at Mount Sinai. But Israel is described as being betrothed to God in Hosea chapter 2. But they served other gods. On marital terms, they cheated. They were unfaithful. Ezekiel 16 lays this out in graphic detail. And so God has to send them away into exile, and it pains him to do it. There's a kind of divorce that takes place. But Isaiah, one of the great prophets, go back to Isaiah chapter 61. Isaiah prophesied that God would be reunited with his people. He would save them from that divorce, from that captivity. And within these beautiful statements are these images of the Messiah. These images of the Jesus that we've been talking about. Isaiah 61 and verse 10. I will surely rejoice in the Lord. My soul shall exult in God. And what is there to celebrate? For he has clothed me with garments of salvation. He has covered me with the robe of righteousness. And what do I look like when he does that? As a bridegroom decks himself like a priest with a beautiful headdress. As a bride adorns herself with jewels. Next chapter, chapter 62, skip down to verse 4. You shall no more be termed forsaken, and your land shall no more be termed desolate, but you shall be called, my delight is in her, and your land married. For the Lord delights in you, and your land shall be married. For as a young man marries a young woman, so shall your sons marry you. As the bridegroom rejoices over the bride, so shall your God rejoice in you. Go back to chapter 54. Beautiful poetry. But look at the symbols that the poet is using to describe what it's going to be like when the Messiah comes. Chapter 54, verse 4. Fear not, for you will not be ashamed. You were ashamed. Be not confounded, for you will not be disgraced. You were disgraced. For you will forget the shame of your youth. And the reproach of your widowhood you will remember no more. For your Maker is your husband. The Lord of hosts is his name. The Holy One of Israel, your Redeemer. The God of the whole earth he is called. For the Lord has called you like a wife deserted and grieved in spirit. Like a wife of youth when she's cast off, says your God. For a brief moment I deserted you. But with great compassion, I will gather you. In overflowing anger, for a moment I hid my face from you. But with everlasting love, I will have compassion on you, says the Lord, our Redeemer. That's what it's going to be like, Isaiah is saying, when the Messiah comes. It's going to be like a wedding, like a marriage. Israel was the unfaithful spouse. But God is going to find a way to cleanse his bride, to purify her and forgive her and have them come together again. The shame, the unfaithfulness of her youth is all forgiven and she's made pure again. That's what Jesus came to do. To make you pure so that you can have the most intimate relationship with God. Jesus is the bridegroom. Hey, Jesus, why are you eating and drinking with all the wrong people? Because the bridegroom is here and there's cause for celebration. This is the symbol. And so, yes, it's right to celebrate because I'm the one who's joining you together in marriage to God. And so his coming was like a wedding. While he was here, the groom and the bride were together. There was cause for celebration. He came, as Paul says in 2 Corinthians 11, I betrothed you to one husband. Right? We're betrothed to God through Christ. And those who keep themselves pure for their spiritual husband are his bride. And who is the bride and who is the groom? Paul, in a wonderful section in Ephesians chapter 5, verses 22 through the end of the chapter, talks about this marriage. Hey, husbands, here's how you be a good husband. You love your wife as Christ loved the church. He gave himself up for her. He purified her to make her that pure, chaste virgin. Oh, and wives, you respect your husband in the same way that you submit in respect to the Lord. This mystery is profound, he says in verse 32. This mystery of marriage, what's it all about? I'm saying that it refers to Christ and the church. As wonderful as your marriage is, it's pointing to something even greater, another sign, if you will, of the greatest marriage. The kingdom of heaven, what's it like? A wedding feast? It's like 10 virgins who are waiting for the bridegroom to come because the party is about to get started. And this is a party that never ends. We'll never run out of provisions. The bridegroom is coming. We have to, as chaste virgins, keep ourselves pure until Jesus comes back, because in Revelation 19, the great marriage will be consummated someday. This is what we're waiting for. Revelation 19, verse 7 and 8. Let us rejoice and exalt and give him glory, for the marriage of the Lamb has come. His bride has made herself ready. It was granted her to clothe herself with fine linen, bright and pure. In the resurrection, the marriage between God and his people will be consummated, will be finalized, and will finally be with our betrothed forever. And here, this bridegroom isn't just dressed like a king. Look in verse 16. He is the king. He's the king of kings. And the church is his bride, dressed in her best. Are you dressed in your best? It's not about this. Right? It's about what's going on inside. That's what God is concerned with. That's what he wants to clothe with pure linen, bright and fine. So where does this land with you? I don't know. I don't know what exactly is going on in your life. But maybe this hits home with you. Maybe you could use and you realize, I need to be changed. And I don't have a relationship with God as it is now. Or I'm distant from God. I don't know exactly what you're going through. But Jesus came to announce the good news of his kingdom, that he wants to bring you to God. He wants to purify you. And the way that he does that is he died for you on the cross. He shed his blood. And when his blood is applied to your life, it makes you clean. And it doesn't matter who you are or what you've done. You are the betrothed of God from that point forward. And the way that you can access that blood, according to Jesus, is being baptized into his death so that you might be raised into newness of life. If that's never happened, if you've never obeyed the gospel in that way and responded to the good news, then this is a call for you to do just that as we sing this song.